Over the Thanksgiving holiday, two of my longest, dearest friends came to visit with their new, soon-to-be-adopted 8-year-old son. It was a joy. We all met in college as undergrads, and even though in the last 20 years we haven't lived in the same place, through a combination of phone calls and texts and letters and a few cross-country trips, we've managed to remain close. And whenever we do get together, there's always some that pull, you know, to retell, to share some memory from that time. It was such a formative time with all the big events. But something about this visit made our memories feel especially tender and alive. I don't know, maybe it's just what it means to be 40-something together now. You know, to find ourselves in the middle of life, with children, marriage, career, house. But more than usual, it was as if we were trying to piece together how one choice led to the next, and then the next, and the next, and then these seemingly scattered moments turned into a whole life, bringing us here, now. And seeing in each other all these years and history, the tragedies, the triumphs, the boring, the truly embarrassing, and everything in between. There are not that many people outside of family who have this kind of stretched out understanding about any of us and the ways our lives could have gone, if only. I found myself this trip especially trying to remember how it was that we all ended up as friends. "Remind me," I said one evening over a competitive card game of Hand and Foot. I said, "Remind me, when did you go from that random person I saw in class once a week to this person that I couldn't imagine not seeing every day? How did that happen? Help me remember." Now, it's not that I don't have my own memories or that we haven't talked about all this 1,000 times before, but I think over this past year, beyond just the tendencies of my age and stage, I think I've learned to become more skeptical of some of my most basic assumptions. And I've realized that doubt and even a little curiosity could be a healthy thing when it comes to some of these long-standing stories of how I assumed life just is. So I think I just needed to check in to re-encounter these formative tales of friendship and becoming and growing up. Remind me. Help me remember how it was. This time of year, many of us find ourselves remembering and retelling old tales, or at least trying to remember and retell old tales. These memories of our lives and how our lives have played out, especially as often we're meeting up with others who call these stories or a version of them their stories too. And even maybe more especially as we remember those who have died who were a part of those stories, and feel anew their absence, no longer able to remember these stories with us. The holidays can be an especially hard time for those of us who've lost loved ones or with strained relationships for precisely this reason. It is a time pregnant with memories, so much so that biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann would caution us to beware of our potential to over-remember, by which he means be careful not to be pulled too much by the past so that we cannot experience the present or allow ourselves to feel the possible emerging future. As the White Queen says to Alice in Through the Looking Glass, it is a poor sort of memory that only works backwards. Despite his warning not to overdo it, Brueggemann's scholarship comes down strongly on the importance of memory as a moral and spiritual tool. You can see this orientation on the quote on the front of your order of service. It says, memory produces hope in the same way that amnesia produces despair. This quote is what inspired the service today, actually, the topic, because I kept thinking about it after I saw it the first time. Memory produces hope in the same way amnesia produces despair. I mean, I've been spending a lot of time in this past year contemplating what produces hope and what wards off despair. But I have to confess, I never once thought of memory. Memory is an extremely complicated concept, despite its omnipresence, not just in the holidays, but daily, weekly, generationally. Memories tell us who we are, and in most cases, we believe them. Which is interesting, since the more we learn about memory, the less reliable source we realize it often is. I mean, I won't go so far as to call memory fake news. But almost. To explain, I'm going to ask you to try out an exercise with me. I'm going to read a series of words, and your job for now is to just listen to the words, okay? Sour, honey, bitter, heart, tooth, nice, sugar, chocolate, taste, tart, candy, soda, good, cake, pie. Okay, so now I want you to grab a pen. And if you don't have a pen, we have a few going around because I realize like nobody carries a pen anymore. So, and you can also use your phone if you wanted. And I'm just going to ask you to jot down the words you remember from what I just said. Any words. It's not a test. You won't turn it in. It's just an exercise. So just whatever words you remember from what I just said. Okay, so I have one more list I'm going to read, and now you know my trick, so don't cheat. Just put your pencils down and your phones down, and again, you're just going to listen, okay? Mad, wrath, fear, happy, hate, fight, rage, hatred, temper, mean, fury, calm, ire, emotion, enrage. Okay, go ahead. Write down the words you remember from what I just said. Okay, now let's go back and look at the whole list. Let's start with the ones you wrote from the first time. And I want you to look there and see if the word sweet is among them. If the word sweet is there, will you raise your hand? Okay, And now look at the words from the second list and see if the word anger is there. If it is, will you raise your hand? Okay, all of you are in that raised your hand, you're in really good company, because 80% of the people who do this exercise pick out sweet and angry as the words they, or anger or angry, that is the words they remember. And by this, I mean you're in really good wrong company. Because of all the words I read, none of them were sweet or angry. On the first service, somebody came up, like, at the end of the service and was like, I need to see the script. I do not believe you. And I do remind you, there is a podcast, so you can go back and listen. But there it is a fascinating thing about memory, that memory works by association, right? So that rather than necessarily remembering the facts, we remember the feelings and ideas that are associated with those facts. So that in this case, this was a setup, sorry. But you had these words that are intentionally, people know that they have an association with the words sweet and angry. And so that the likelihood is you are probably going to remember the word sweet, even if the word sweet wasn't there. This is what researchers Paul Doherty and Pat Murphy describe as the difference between remembering story truth and happening truth. So happening truth is the bare facts, what happened at such and such a time. And story truth is the story you tell yourself about that truth, the details that your brain fills in, the version that helps you make sense of the world. Memories include both of these, the things we heard and observed and also felt, and also the things we hear later and suggestions from others. And they are filtered through our existing stories, the way we understand ourselves already and the way we understand life. And over time, all this just becomes integrated so that we really can't tell which part is which. It's all just seamless memory. Psychologist Elizabeth Loftus says that people are often very disturbed by this idea because we feel attached to our remembered past and the people, places, and events that we enshrine in our memory translate in our minds as if they are our actual selves and our real life. And if we can't trust our memories as real, then we wonder if we really know ourselves and who we are at all, or what's real in life at all. Now, as I started to learn about this whole switch idea of memory, I was at first kind of disturbed, as she described. But then I started to realize that actually this could be very good news for many. And I was thinking especially it would be good news for my cousin, Michelle. So Michelle, she's just a little older than I am. She's an accomplished pediatrician and an advocate for children who have experienced abuse. She's an awesome mom and wife and friend. And Michelle has early onset Alzheimer's. Since her diagnosis, Michelle has been incredibly public about her journey, which means that even though she lives far away, when I saw her a couple months ago for a family reunion, I wasn't completely surprised that she sometimes forgot words. And when we were in a conversation, sometimes she forgot where we were in that conversation. And sometimes I wondered as we talked if for a moment or more, she forgot me. And by the next time I see her, I know she will have forgotten a lot more. So many of us today love someone who lives with dementia or other memory loss, or we live with it ourselves. Dementia can create in us a painful spiritual crisis, or at least it can if we imagine that we are our memories, and that our memories are us. From this perspective, dementia makes us wonder if there is some point in the forgetting process when the person will no longer be the person. Because as the memories dissolve, we wonder if the self dissolves as well. But in this new understanding of memory, we realize that we have all this entirely backwards. Our memories do not represent a set of series of fixed events that, when stacked back to back, add up to us. Because even in a brain without Alzheimer's or dementia, memories are malleable and constantly under construction, subject perpetually to what leftists calls post-event information. So much so that with the right combination of factors, any of us can be completely certain of a memory that never actually happened, and completely forget one that did. If anything, instead of our lives being the sum of all of our memories, our memories are the sum of us at any given time, changing and becoming as we change and become. So that, as William Faulkner put it, the past isn't dead. It isn't even past. Now, I know in many ways this understanding of how our memories work, it runs counter to our common assumptions. But at the same time, I don't think it's new to realize that our individual and collective memories can be unreliable sources for truth. We are all susceptible to what Brueggemann calls selective remembering or selective forgetting. And here, I realized too late last night that perhaps this is where I should play, if you've seen it, the thing going around of Jeff Sessions on a loop saying, "I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall." They've turned it into a catchy song, it turns out. You can find it, it's actually great. But it's not actually funny. But we are all susceptible to this selective remembering or selective forgetting. Whether due to our desire to see ourselves a certain way or avoid the pain of a past event, or even just because we were distracted and not paying full attention, or 1,000 other possible reasons, we all at times consciously or subconsciously forget portions of our past. As an example, about a year ago, Sean and I started talking about the possibility of this congregation ordaining him. We just finished my installation, which we knew marked the first new senior ministry in about a quarter century for Foothills. And we wondered if the last ordination had been any more recent. So we asked around to a number of you, and we searched the church history and archives, and eventually we found our story. In 1991, Foothills ordained the Reverend Thomas Perchlick, who coincidentally was last summer called to serve the UU congregation in Olympia, Washington, where my sister is a member. So I got in touch with him, and Thomas confirmed our understanding with good memories and appreciation, and we all marveled that yet again we'd be marking something in this congregation in this short span of time that was 25 years or more in the making. And we shared this story frequently as we got closer to Sean's ordination. And many who have been members since 91 or earlier remembered Reverend Perchlick fondly and shared our excitement that we'd celebrate together again this first historic ordination by Foothills in about 26 years. And this story and our collective memory of it would have all remained just like this, maybe forever, if it wasn't for a Facebook post about a colleague's death shared a couple of months ago. It was a remembrance of the Reverend Stephen Mead Johnson, who was, according to the post, a complicated figure, but one who had done important ministry, especially in his service to the UU congregation in Laramie at the time of Matthew Shepard's death. The writer remarked that this was noteworthy because it was early in Reverend Johnson's ministry. He'd been ordained just a few months earlier at the Foothills Unitarian Church in Fort Collins. That was 1998, as in 7 years after what we thought had been the last ordination. Now, I know that ordination of ministers is not everyone's big news. So it's not strange that hardly anyone would remember or correct our big pronouncement of the first ordination in a quarter century. But the fact that no one remembered or brought it up, it was funny. So I challenged the person who posted this story, thinking he must be misremembering. But then a few other colleagues jumped in on the string and said they'd been at the ordination. Definitely at Foothills. I asked if maybe it was that Laramie had done the ordaining and we just hosted it. But the ministers in attendance said no. Foothills ordained him because he did his internship here. Mark Salkin preached the sermon. It definitely happened. And from what I can tell from our database, over 150 of you who are active today were around at the time. But for some reason, we just forgot. And here's my theory about why. Here's what I know about 1998 in this church. It was right after a major church conflict. A conflict so painful that still today people describe to me, not how painful it was then, they tell me that, but they say how painful it is still now. I'm told about 100 members left the church at the time. So my theory is that the story that we retained about that time in the church, it is not a happy celebration of ordaining a new minister sort of story. It's a story of struggle and conflict, loss, pain. And this story truth, over time, overcame the fullness of the happening truth. There are probably other factors. But it's at least one theory. Like I said, this happens all the time in our collective memories and individual lives. The process, consciously or subconsciously, for selection and curation. But as my spiritual director reminds me often, much to my chagrin, those things in ourselves that are unknown to us are also the things that often control us. The things unknown in us often control us. And just as importantly, selective remembering prevents us from knowing the fullness of who we have been and therefore the fullness of who we might still be. For example, our selective remembering keeps us focused on the story truth that in 1998 we experienced a big conflict that we simply powered through and survived, thank God. But the fuller truth is that it was also a time when we claimed the unique power of congregations to ordain a new minister, one whose ministry immediately made a big difference in Laramie. And actually, between the services, somebody told me, oh, I remember him. And he also was one of the key factors in revitalizing our campus ministry at CSU, leading to the hire of Justin Schroeder, who is now the minister at the First Universalist Church of Minneapolis. It is only in the bringing to consciousness, the surfacing and the revising of these fuller memories, which, of course, is possible only in community because, like truth, we all have a piece. Only through storytelling and song, rituals and prayers that performing our memories, where we can intentionally remember ourselves. Only here can we claim that fuller freedom and the capacity to choose more intentionally the story that we're going to live from. And I think here is where memory produces hope. When we can hold it all, listening and learning the threads that we have too often neglected or failed to fully know as our own, in this we realize how resilient we can be. What lives in us already? What lessons we have learned from these failures, these triumphs, We feel ourselves a part of this great arc of life that marches on through it all, just keeps marching on. As the poem goes, freedom is daily, prose bound, routine remembering, putting together inch by inch the starry world from all the lost collections. In these next few weeks of Advent and the holiday season, as we encounter once again the ancient stories of Christmas and Hanukkah, as we sing familiar carols and share in familiar holiday rituals, we will inevitably feel the waves come in and out, the waves of memories, both bitter and sweet. And as we do, we have the chance once again to remember ourselves whole, holy, a part of this past that is still unfolding, still becoming, a chance to claim for us all a resilient hope for the future that together we can still create by memory. May it be so.